All right. Thank you very much. Well, this has been an exciting week already. I mean, last week with the talks and today. Indeed, a topic that we've been discussing for more than 25 years, black holes and information. I think we're learning quite a bit, and maybe many of the things that we've said in this week's, if you string them in the right ways together and cut out the things that are wrong, someone must have said some story that may be right, but it's try to connect the dots there. So this will be part of that, where I try to add some dots that may be part of the story, and I hope they can eventually be connected. So some of the talks we heard last week, I think, are quite similar, and also this morning's talks. I mean, the presentations by Lenny and Juan, I think there are similar ideas that Herman and I have been expressing, and also, I wasn't there, but John Preskill talked about this final state proposal. I think that contains an element, which I will come to in this talk. And of course, the work of Raju and Papadodimas, and also Nomura, I think they express related ideas. So actually, also I should have mentioned the talk that Ted Jacobson gave, which I was quite impressed by. I think he mentioned some of the points that I think are sort of similar. So I feel convergence happening to the situation where people are believing there's something that we can say about the physics behind the horizon by using, clever arguments. So I'm going to actually draw a similar picture as Ted did. I mean, just to set the stage, where we think about forming a black hole, and just for concreteness, and since people like it, put it in ADS, and I think about the small black hole. And so where we think about states formed by gravitons, and you can think about this as a gas of gravitons. I mean, there's quite an important distinction between small black holes and large black holes. Large black holes have this enormous degeneracy of states, and they're not clearly able to express them always in terms of gas of gravitons, but for small black holes it's even much clearer. I mean, you can even think about building a star out of gravitons and put enough gravitons on top of it so that it starts collapsing. This is one thing, the way we studied this. One thing we learned, by the way, in that way, is that the counting of gravitons, or the number of gravitons that we have inside a black hole, is not a very well-defined number. So this whole particle number calculation and sort of specifying states by their particle number may not be a very good thing to do if we have black holes. But still, we think you can do it approximately, and then we have the radiation coming out, also in terms of gravitons or whatever, photons, some low-energy quantum field theory modes. But in the middle of it, we have this black hole, and that's some complicated state, probably very strongly interacting, entangled, and so on. And we don't have a very good semi-classical description except in terms of space-time. The actual number of states should still be there. So eventually, everything comes out, and we're going to be interested, indeed, in the usual picture where there will be some modes that I will call B. And then there's the early radiation that comes out, R. And I will look at the black hole, indeed, at a certain time. So anything that comes out later will be called the late radiation. But that is still contained then at this moment inside the black hole, if we could put in some stretched horizon. So that means that if I start from an initial state, and indeed, I can think about this, as I described here, as some time evolution of a state I created out of the vacuum of the, so in this case, the ADS space. Then after some time, I write this, let me call it a capital phi. Of course, I have a number of letters to write down, so let's try to distinguish them. Then here I'm going to separate it into a psi for the black hole. So I'm going to first look actually at the situation when I have only the early radiation, and then it sort of separates into black hole states and early radiation, but then we also want to include now the modes in this zone in the interaction where we have some additional gravitons emitted. So here I will write it as C psi H, which is the stuff that's left behind in the black hole. And then we have modes describing the gravitons, which are in the B sector. And this is all entangled with the radiation. And since the radiation indeed contains most of the states, this entanglement is the usual thing we are worrying about. So in order to define this state at this moment, what we had to do is to take the modes that come out here and calculate them backwards in such a way that they sort of come reasonably close to the horizon. And therefore, we sort of know that these states sort of exist from the point of view of the outside observer. Actually, I do believe firewalls exist. Because actually, we started arguing for firewalls about 20 years ago. Actually, this picture of calculating backwards was done 25 years ago by Gerard het Hooft, who started calculating backwards even further and said these things were colliding here. And the geometry which you get by doing this quantum field theory and calculating backwards looked totally different than any semi-classical geometry. And I remember standing in Joe's office in the other building 20 years ago, a conference in 93, where we precisely were calculating backwards to the horizon, and where we said, well, there's something very special happening because those modes, they are getting blue shifted, and it's a very special place. And Joe said, no, of course not. This looks locally like the vacuum because these particles are virtual. There's no way, there's no reason why you should calculate backwards. And here I am 20 years later, and Joe gave me exactly the talk where he calculates backwards and reasons for the existence of a firewall. But what we said 20 years ago was not that there was a firewall. There's a firewall for the outside observer. Because okay, so in order to explain what is happening, of course, it does not exist. Yeah, I'll come to that. And actually, I'm going to explain why, what might be going on here, but does not exist for infalling. That was at least the idea of complementarity. And so it's where you take one particular outstate, I suppose, and that you calculate backwards. That's fine, but the point is that a state is not even the vacuum. And so what we actually did at that time, we were actually working at the time on a paper which came out 2 years later. It's a usual slow paper, which is 95, which where we defined a form of complementarity. And we basically want to specify when can we trust statements from semi-classical physics. And we said, yeah, you can write down the propagation of two states. Even if it's the vacuum, you have to be careful. The vacuum would say, you say it's a semi-classical state, it's empty space. How can we not trust semi-classical propagation? Well, the vacuum is quite a complicated state, because it has support on many fields. So a state is a wave function of fields that you write down on your final surface and on your initial surface. And this is going to be quite important, because even if we think about the vacuum, actually, it's the next thing I wanted to say, the vacuum itself, I mean, this state, we are worried about the entanglement that we, in this state, which contains all the operators. But the vacuum itself is a very complicated state with lots of entanglement. And the reason is that has a support on many functionals. So in writing down a state and whether we can trust it, we should also include in which Hilbert space it acts. So here I have some in states, say phi 1 and 2, and I have to think about what are the functionals on which I have to define this wave function. Even when it's a vacuum, it has to live on fields of order square root of h bar. If you want to have n particles here, it's square root h bar times n, because the amplitudes have to be of the right order. Now, when can we trust semi-classical propagation? We said all of these fields, the only support that you allow, must be such that in the solution you write down from here to here, which is specified by the initial state and the final state, has to be a semi-classical solution where nothing weird happens, no Planckian collisions, no black hole formations, and so on. If you restrict your questions only to those kind of questions about the state, you won't run into paradoxes. So we call the space-time complementarity because it doesn't even refer to horizons. It doesn't refer to observers. It simply tells you when can you trust semi-classical analysis. And you will see that if you do this here, of course, calculating backwards this way, you would run into some problems.
Sorry, I didn't follow. You said you had to restrict the solutions that include no black holes, but then you said it's not, has nothing to do with horizons.
The restriction that we put on the fields that we put here is that there's only semi-classical physics you can put here. How should I say this? The reason I don't think we should include horizons is because we don't really trust that we have the complete description of the phase space when we do gravity with black hole formation anyway. So if I want to describe the phase space and so the propagation of information contained in quantum fields, this is what I mean to say here. So I want to discuss propagation of information, and I have to allow only fields with certain cutoffs in here in such a way that the semi-classical propagation on these states just looks normal.
You draw a propagating wave forward and backwards, at least from the...
You mean something like that?
Yeah, so if the phi 1 propagates forwards and the phi 2 propagates backwards and the two had collided at a very large energy at some point, then you cannot trust the wave function propagation from the initial slice to the final slice on these field configurations.
Well,
so the black hole that Eric was talking about could have been formed, or at least something that is,
if it's
quantum gravitational, that could have been formed in the evolution between the two slices.
Well, if you put something here that forms a black hole, then already, of course, we know that we shouldn't trust the whole propagation from here to here, because we know we form a black hole. But even if I want to know propagation, well, maybe I should draw the usual picture. The usual argument was that if you take the state here, you don't need to calculate backwards all the way. You can calculate backwards from here to here. But in order to describe this state, you have to calculate forward from here to here. And so if you ask whether this state can be trusted from this perspective, you're restricting to different field configurations than if you ask which field configurations you can trust when you go backwards.
So
we call this admissible cutoffs. And we basically said there are different cutoffs that you can put on this slide depending on what you allow yourself to do.
I don't want to distract you too much from your talk, but is this supposed to be something which is, in principle, a kind of in-out formulation? Or can I ask in-in questions as well and then disregard whatever's in the final state?
Well, I think in-out is very clear, because in-in questions, I think, are a little more subtle. I mean, because they have more of they do inclusive questions. But
so you would, I mean, the point of this is that, of course, if I summed over the final configurations, I might think that I could use states that make black hole for certain purposes. But you're going to say, no, we should still stay away from
it. I think for information unitarity of the whole process, I think the in-out formulation is necessary. But I don't want to spend too much time on this, because I think it's just going back to some old idea. But anyway, maybe if you want to go ahead.
Yeah,
right.
So when you're making these statements, are
yes.
you referring to the situation in a quantum field theory description before we have some modification that gets the information out, or
yes.
are you okay and not to the
I'm not
situation
going to talk about
modified.
This is,
good
I'm just so, limiting the questions yeah. that we can ask with quantum field theory.
Okay, so well, so in quantum field theory, another way of putting it is there are all kinds of really wild configurations in the functional interval in quantum field theory.
Yes.
But they never matter. They average out and they don't
that
matter.
That was the usual story.
Well, that is the story in quantum field theory. And here what happens is there's a similar situation that, you know, if you just restrict to looking at the stuff just outside the horizon, you have really wild stuff, but it's paired with the stuff inside in quantum field theory. And when you try to cross it, there's a cancellation that takes place.
So I agree when you treat them as virtual modes, I would not have much against it. But here we're discussing the modes that have sort of become real as particles that go out, and there we have trouble understanding them. But so I'm going to actually make a distinction between the virtual modes, because I think this was basically also the argument that Joe gave us at the time. You can go in here because these excitations are virtual. And precisely what you just said, there are all kinds of calculations that smoothen out all of these effects, and therefore there's nothing going on at the horizon. And I think that argument is still correct. I believe also that argument. But that's part of what complementarity is. So we have to understand why the virtual modes can help us to go across horizons, while the modes that we have sort of calculated backwards and which are real create the firewall. And so this is complementarity. So I'm not. This is just an introduction, sort of, as why I'm going to distinguish between virtual and real. I mean, because as I said, the vacuum. And maybe I should go back to the things that Mark talked about. We know that even in the Sitter space, anti-De Sitter space, if I look at the vacuum, this is the state up here. And I want to define entanglement. I can define it as an entangled state. So the vacuum is highly entangled. It's even an infinite entanglement if I allow this surface to go all the way to the boundary. So even the vacuum is entangled, and this is why things are connected. And I think that entanglement is very similar to the entanglement, of course, in Minkowski space. Here we can write down the vacuum state as a particular, well, we've seen the formulas many times. I'll call it NA and NB of this sort. And another way of drawing this is that there are indeed states out here that are entangled with here. And I like to draw this like this, where I have a state NB here and a state NA here. And they have a certain weight that we have here. But this allows you, for instance, this entanglement is very important for the connectivity of space-time. And one way I like to think about it is that if I annihilate a particle here, it's the same as creating a particle there. We also know that entangled pairs help us in transferring information from one side to the other, maybe something like quantum teleportation. So I think the way we cross horizon is sort of like we are constantly quantum teleporting ourselves. We're making use of this entanglement all the time. But this is an entanglement in the vacuum. Because this has no information, because the vacuum is a single state without any information. This is all virtual stuff that's happening here, nothing real. And this is where all the cancellations you talked about happen. So I'm going to allow this, and actually we even count this entanglement. It's not infinite. It's A over 4G, we now believe. It's sort of measured by Newton's constant. So this entanglement is there. It's a virtual entanglement in the vacuum. So the entanglement we talk about for black holes is a very different kind, because that's an entanglement. We do like to do the same thing for black holes. If we have a black hole here, we believe if we draw a surface around it, it has the same kind of entanglement. But here we're talking about real states sitting here. And those are the real states, for instance, that we can associate with psi. And the reason why we think that entanglement is essential, because we want to have something going across, is that we think, well, there must be some entanglement between here and here. That would create a smooth horizon. The problem that we are dealing with is that this entanglement is brought over to the other one because of the fact that this one is maximally entangled as a system already here. And so we're destroying the entanglement between those two. Now, let me now say a theorem. It's called Einstein locality. Long-range entanglement can have no local consequence. So we should never have believed this argument. If I do a measurement, this is what I said in November, if I do a measurement here and project, it should not affect any local outcome here. So how can we ever believe that this entanglement between this state and that state has any relevance for the discussion here? So I'm going to write it down as a theorem. And then I'm going to ask you to vote.
I'm sorry, since you're writing this down as a theorem, will you define precisely what you mean by long-range entanglement and no
between something here and Andromeda?
Yes.
And where entanglement exists, yes or no, is that locally measurable? Here. So who believes that this is true? Who believes that this thing is true? I actually... So what I want to say, if I write down the state here, where I write down here an I, sorry, I'm going to do the following. I'm writing down the state I sum here. That's a maximally entangled state past page time. Here I write down the same state that sort of evolves with, but then let me actually erase it this way. Is there a local way in which you can distinguish the fact that I erased it or not?
So, Eric, I think you're saying something stronger than this, though. What you're saying is that if I have some pure state versus if I have the density matrix just in this system, that I can't tell the difference between them, for example, by only doing, you know, one-shot experiment. I think that's what you're really trying to say, right?
I mean, we make use of this in quantum mechanics all the time.
Well, I mean, we certainly don't think that the Maxwellian mixed density matrix is the same as being in a pure state.
I think I make, so what I'm saying is the following. If I do a measurement on a system, I entangle it with the measurement apparatus, I take the measurement apparatus very far away, and then I look at the outcome of a measurement, I can treat that state that I got as a pure state.
Eric, I don't understand. For example, Newton's law comes about in quantum field theory. When I look at the wave function, say, of two static sources, then that wave function has a phase in it that correlates the position of the two sources that tells me what the Newtonian potential is. That's entanglement, right?
The entanglement.
Are you talking about long-range effects here, or are you?
Yeah, but the entanglement that Eric talks about is the EPR type entanglement. At least if you have an EPR pair, you have two sides of an EPR pair. There's one spin here. There's another spin in Andromeda. Then you cannot notice the difference between the properties of this one spin in this room, depending on whether someone is doing a measurement in Andromeda. So this is always when people talk about EPR, then Einstein said, well, something funny is happening. Because it seems as if the measurement over there influences the state over here. And then we go in classrooms and we explain that the effect of the measurement there can never have any observable consequences in this room. And that's a theorem. And that's the theorem that Eric is referring to. It's the fact that if you do measurements on an entangled situation where something is very far away, you can never send signals faster than the speed of light.
I call this Einstein locality. And I think if you look in Wikipedia, you can probably see the definition of what it is.
Do you include the possibility that a measurement far away can have an effect inside a black hole nearby?
I don't think it can. But I don't think you will, let's say it this way. The property of having a firewall, for instance, which is whether this thing is entangled, yes or no, is a locally measurable property. And I think it cannot depend on the fact that there is.
Okay, so you think.
So that if there's a firewall, there should be a firewall for generic.
That Alice far away cannot send the message to the interior of Bob's black hole by making a measurement.
Not by using entanglement.
Using entanglement. Just not forget using entanglement. Yeah, two entangled black holes.
Okay, so this is where you are trying to escape the long range.
No, I'm not trying to escape. I just want to know what the boundary conditions in your question are.
I'm just saying, I mean, I think I specified it here, indeed, whether I erased the sum here, yes or no, whether that is something you can see locally near the. I think.
Alice can certainly send a message to Bob that Bob can receive after he has jumped through the horizon of the black hole.
Just for the ordinary EPR calls, the Portland still go out.
No.
From one exterior to the other, you can't.
So, Eric?
Yes.
I agree with the statement if that's appropriately formulated. If that's, of course, in fact, more is what I was saying. But you can locally measure if psi and n and b and h is entangled. Of course, you can locally measure psi and n.
Psi and n.
Yeah. And if you psi and n can be entangled, depends on if psi and phi is entangled.
No.
So unless.
No. The properties of this system.
No, if you write this way, if the psi and the phi is the maximum entangle, you cannot entangle psi and n. If you write that way, I don't write that way, but
the consequence of whether these states are entangled, yes or no, which is indeed whether we can go through the horizon, should not depend on whether this thing. Actually, I should call it in your language.
Yeah, that's
if I
statement.
Have
I agree.
This thing but is entangled. It looks like the vacuum. If I give it a number I,
yeah,
and I entangle that I with something there, should not matter. Not matter at all.
I'm sorry. I feel like you just said that if it's entangled, it looks like the vacuum, and if it's not entangled, it doesn't. And I don't think we ever suggested that entanglement was equivalent to being a vacuum state.
Fine. And then I agree this because I don't think we need it. So the fact that the entanglement is swapped to here should not be relevant for the discussion whether it looks like the vacuum state. That's the only thing I wanted to get to.
You're going to explain that?
Yes. It should not, because it's sort of a consequence of the fact that if you entangle something far away, it should not matter locally.
Oh, because of a weak.
No, we're talking about.
It's just the fact that there is an entanglement, and if it puts the entanglement somewhere else again,
I think in
Lenny's speak, if I would extend the wormhole to another one, that should not matter locally to what happens near the horizon.
What matters to the horizon is whether you destroy short-range entanglements, not whether you create new long-range ones.
Yes. Okay. But now, of course, the question is, what is it entangled with? Because, I mean, if we say there's a firewall, then there's nothing behind the horizon, and then we need to, of course, to invoke something that we know that the black hole states are entangled with early radiation. But I'm not going to use that. I'm going to describe the local physics locally by making use of this statement that I can introduce, without introducing any new information, entanglement. I can represent this entanglement locally. I'm going to describe a local rule of how this entanglement is involved in here. I can describe even what happens to Alice going in and how Bob should retrieve anything that Alice does. And it's very easy. I'm going to picture that one. I'm going to raise this question. Well, actually, I can do it. Of course, let me indeed think about this picture, these steps. I'm going to start with phi, which evolves, and it gives me the state phi, and maybe I should draw it a little further down, phi I of the radiation, and this becomes my black hole state. Now, one way to draw it is indeed to split this now again into a state that becomes n of b and psi of h. Now, there are some formulas that go with this, which are just transition amplitudes that tell you how these things would progress. And you would see, you can figure out how all the entanglements are. But now I want to describe what happens to the infalling observer. And there's a very easy way to do it. I just add this in it, locally. Because this picture is the same picture, really, information theoretically, between this one and that one. Of course, if I now look at this picture here, I maybe should draw it a little further down. I've added some things which weren't there in the beginning, but of course, information theoretically, all these things continue. I've added here the other picture down here, the virtual state, the vacuum state. And NB becomes NA here, and it has a certain weight. And the weight here actually can be determined by requiring that whatever calculation I do here, so this is 5R, I do here will be the same result as I get here. And since I know that the Hilbert space of the black hole here is reduced, it actually tells you that this should be in a thermal state with the temperature determined by the black hole, because otherwise you cannot get the same density matrix from these states. Tracing over this state will make this internal state here, and the same it will do here. So now, how do I describe Alice falling in? Well, the usual story is simply this looks like the vacuum locally, but this is the vacuum state. So the information goes here and there.
Sir, can you just explain, so usually when people draw pictures like that, there's some measurement or something that happens where you snuck in that vacuum? So
I just draw down the line. It's information theoretically, nothing happening there.
Okay, but nothing is actually happening there.
There's nothing happening there.
That's something, though, I mean.
So it's true that when I cut the Hilbert space here, I transit in a trivial factor, but if I look right down the tensor products, I added a tensor product of a Hilbert space B and A, and actually I should probably call it the, I don't dare tilde, but something like these are the virtual modes which come real a little later.
So that came out of somewhere that's unphysical? Or?
It's the same picture. It's the same picture.
I guess maybe to expand on Daniel's question, could you tell us what the Hilbert space dimensions are, or I mean, is that?
Oh yeah, yeah. I will start counting in a minute.
Okay.
I mean, it's not very important how big this space is, because that simply tells you how many modes you're gonna allow. But I'll count a little bit, because I mean, I'm gonna be able to even determine the weight. Okay, let me do this in a minute. Yeah, maybe I should do this now. I think that's fine. So what, I've not done anything there yet. I just took the evolution step from here to here. I just told you how to get to this state. Because it's the same step, I just made this step in two steps. I've not done anything. I put a step in the middle where I simply, so what I basically did, so, okay, if you should have asked the question here, of course. So what was the question here? Because what I'm done here is a very trivial step. I just, as you say, tensor in a factor. I don't do anything. And then I just have a map that brings it down here. This was a unitary evolution, so this is a unitary map. And actually, I've transferred the information from the black hole to this state, And it's indeed by some projection and some unitary rotation, but then you sum over the projections, because you simply make it into a unitary map. The Hilbert space here and here is equally large. Here's the pair creation, but here it seems more like the atom emitting a particle.
So you're adding new degrees of freedom in order to be able to describe the interior? Is that
virtual?
Adding virtual degrees.
I tense it in a vector here. But actually, now I'm going to add new degrees of freedom, because I'm going to tell you what happened to Alice falling in. And this is the point that Herman was saying. I've added now this Hilbert space, and this Hilbert space indeed is needed if I want to be able to describe what Alice has seen. Because now I've not talked about Alice at all. There's the vacuum there. But the usual question, I haven't gotten it yet, is that someone can go in and do something here. Well, go ahead and do something. Okay. I can calculate what's going on. Any operator you act with, I can tell you what comes out. So if Alice goes in, I can even see that Alice goes in. And she can use these factors and start doing what she wants to do. It's very simple math. You can simply calculate what's going on. Because I just use this picture, Alice goes in, she does what she does, and I can read it off. And there's nothing inconsistent about that. And it's true, this is operator dependent, because what this state is, it's a virtual state, it's a placeholder. Because here it's going to be projected in such a way that eventually information theoretically, of course, the whole picture goes back to here.
So those states don't count in the thermodynamic ensembles, is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
How did you know to write vacuum? You could have put some other state there, okay. And then you get a different answer.
So I told you how I can calculate this. So the vacuum means I have to have some way in which the information continues here. So the Hilbert space here is equally big as there. I can rotate this anyway, except the weights I put in here, I have to determine. And those weights are these ones. So how do I determine those? Is by requiring that any calculation I do in this picture, yes, this picture.
So if we act with the unitary on NA, then your description of what Alice sees will change, won't it?
No, NA is sort of introduced, but because NA you see sort of continues here. So any unitary I put here can be sort of transferred to unitary there. This is just a continuing line.
Question. I agree that this is a way to calculate and to see what happens. I think I agree with it.
Maybe I should do the counting, because I got a question about counting. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Do you agree that another way is equivalent, like psi n, separable state, to project onto the right basis? Is that the equivalent? Like maximally entangled basis?
This one?
Yeah. And this one, the relation between the two. I thought it's kind of equivalent.
Of course equivalent, because I haven't done much. I've just really introduced the tensor factor and then projected back again.
Yeah, that's one way.
So there's no information added or subtracted, so it's all unitary. I just added a virtual Hilbert space that I can use for the purpose of describing the informal observer. And therefore, I can calculate even what's going on with that observer.
Yeah.
I can also calculate how large this Hilbert space is, because there's a little confusion here in my mind, because if I regard this as a black hole state, I mean, there's even an idea that you can indeed write generic states that look like this, which is your argument. I can count how many states there are. And that also is actually involved in calculating the normalization of this factor. So how many states do I have here? If I assume the black hole here has a mass m, then the state that I have here has a mass m minus en, and I sum over all possible states n, and what is this? This is e to the s of m times the sum over n e to the minus beta en, which is z times e to the. So you will see that the partition function of the system, actually, you require more states of this form if you write them purely as a tensor product Hilbert space. So the states that you get in this tensor product is only a subspace of the full set of states that I get in there. So you can excite these modes and indeed create a bigger Hilbert space than the Hilbert space of the original black hole. And for instance, that's precisely what Alice can do when she falls in there, she can actually start exciting those states. So all of those states exist, but they don't exist as states that can evolve from the black hole states. You can excite them by going there with your device and putting in the measurement apparatus and creating particles. Of course you can do this. And this can be here as well, because you basically go in here and excite and make this mode into a different one. You have to add to your CFT the possibility of putting an observer there. And this is adding a tensor factor with a Hilbert space, with all the stuff. You have to give Alice all the equipment to go there and do all her stuff. And this is adding states to the theory. Because if you look at the full evolution of the theory, you should leave it undisturbed. And this is precisely what's going on here. So the evolution is actually doing this step, but you can also represent it like that. You have to be very careful. She may be scrambled before you know it. I mean, this is. Well, I think I can, because I mean, there's a certain way that I can still allow interactions between those modes.
Alice was already part of I. Eric didn't say it. It was.
Eric.
There's another Alice.
I mean, I don't think I'm changing the story, but.
No, if someone falls into a black hole, they form also, they become part of the black hole.
I mean, either if she falls in, of course, they become part of the black hole. So she was either part of the state when you drop her in. But if you would like to keep her, okay, yeah, if she drops in some later time, yeah, I mean, this is something we should take into account, yes.
So actually an elementary question even before this. So you've got these two diagrams, and there's a vertex on the left, which is psi black hole, goes into psi H and NB. And that is presumably basically a unitary operation, right?
It's a unit. You have to put a coefficient here.
That's a unitary.
That's correct.
Now, over here, you have psi BH and NA goes into psi H. And that is presumably, what, not a unitary? It's like the final state?
It's correct that if you ask which states you can build here that can evolve into here, it's a subspace of these states where you would.
So you have to project to go to go one step up.
Yeah.
So it's not a unit.
Yeah. But if you want to include this, it is.
Well.
Because it's even equivalent to this.
So it does look a little bit like the final state.
It's like the final state. It's like I borrow a little bit from here. But it's just a virtual representation of what's going on, because the total step. So I've just split this time step into two steps, where I first introduce the virtual state. There I can describe everything that's going on near the horizon. And I even can calculate what is the consequence for the full final state. And there's nothing non-unitary, because once nothing is happening here, I don't even use this Hilbert space, because it's all equivalent to what's going on here. And there's no reason, by the way, that the Hamiltonian of the infalling observer has any relationship with the Hamiltonian of the outside of observer, because they're talking about very different time variables. So I've just given you a representation of the process in which you can calculate what's going on with an infalling observer. And I think this gives a prescription of what Alice can do here and how we can measure it on the outside. And I think that's all that we needed to do, is to have some reality of the infalling observer that can transmit messages to us, and that we are able to unscramble from the outside radiation. I think this picture just does that. And there's no non-unitarity. There's no. I mean, it's true that you ask whether the evolution here inside has some Hamiltonian evolution. I think that has never been sort of the question, because I don't think we want to describe Alice all the way, because we know she's not able to live very long anyway, and her Hilbert space presumably is getting smaller all the time, because exactly this is what's happening here. We get the Hilbert space of the black hole being smaller.
This is resolving this issue of the infalling observer by saying that the infalling observer carries in this additional thing. But there's something else you could do. You could take the small black hole and allow it to evaporate and wait for a time that's of order the page time till eventually everything comes out.
Yes.
And then if I had a very powerful computer, I could take my boundary degrees of freedom and trace them back, and then ask from that perspective, what are the correlation functions?
Okay, so I think you'll find the same result that you get from this diagram.
But now you don't have the additional degrees of freedom that the infalling...
I agree. So this is correct. But so this is why I call this a placeholder, because this saves me to do all the work, because I can use this placeholder to do it. But then by this projection, or whatever what happens here, it's going to turn into the operator that you just defined. So the part of the problem of the error correction, which I don't think is fully realizable, because we run into the problem that you mentioned also, there's no definition of these operators that can be made independent of the state. So I introduced this factor here simply because I could then use it to calculate. But then by, if you ask which is the information that's being used, that information is not contained in one particular factor of the Hilbert space. We never said that it should be a tensor factor of the inside observer, because once you have it, you lose information. So there should not be independent operators of, because if you have state-independent operators describing the inside observer, that's, I think, equivalent to almost losing information. And this was always known. But once you, the only task is, can we describe some reality to the infalling observer? And I think we can do this here. But if you go to the diagram, it will tell you that it indeed depends exactly on all of those, that information in here.
So is the projection is real or not? I mean, we're doing final state quantum mechanics, or we're doing... you just said projection there, so I'm just...
Okay, so if you want to, I mean, I think it's not difficult to write. I mean, this you probably can figure out what it means in quantum mechanics. Simply, it's a unitary evolution from this Hilbert space to this one. And I've just told you what I've done here. I just first took this, and then rewrite the same step as a projection operator, where I indeed project this one out in such a way that I end up with the state that you would have got here. So it's just decomposition of the two.
I mean, isn't that what Horowitz and Maldacena say, though? They say if you look outside, you've just got quantum mechanics, but then if you want to look inside, then now you've post-select.
One
other thing.
Can I reply to that? Again, Eric explained it beautifully and clearly. He said on the left that's the quantum mechanics that he's describing. And it's just representing the unitary evolution on the left, which has no problem whatsoever with final state projections. There's no final state projection in the left. And it's equivalent to what's happening on the right. So this was actually when I was reading Juan's and Gary's paper, to me it was always clear that this was what's going on, is that actually they were doing exactly this, right? They were tensoring in this vacuum, which at that point, people should have raised their hand, say, hey, what are you doing there? And now you're doing it finally. But at that point, you should say, why are you tensing it in? Oh, the answer at that point is, just wait. Just wait until we're done. And then they do their projection, which is not at all a mistake at all, because they restore the left diagram at that point, and the left diagram is perfectly unitary.
So, anyway, It's here.
One shouldn't call it post-selection. One should call it unitary quantum.
So it's not final state. I agree.
It's not just final state.
It's partial projection, but it's just the reduction of the. It's just when you're done, you've done it, and you can of course extend it further, but it doesn't do anything. And so the realization that this diagram and that diagram is the same. This is unitary evolution. This is just extending it a little bit. And so what the infalling observer is, he's using the local entanglement, which is purely virtual, to define what's going on inside. And so he doesn't need the information from the early radiation. The operators you write down here are not the operators that act on the early radiation. They're just there when you start, go there and use something to measure.
Do you agree that in distant view, even in distant, you said that R is falling in, R is cannot send the signal to the distant observer, so you don't need to describe. No, even in the distant view, you can describe what Aris will be feeding. Of course, what
she feels the vacuum. But
of course, it's a super hyper entangled.
But I'm claiming she can do.
Should be able to agree. Yeah.
She can do something to this state by exciting this mode and making the vacuum not a vacuum, and that should be visible on the outside, so we can exactly see what Alice is doing on the inside, and
Eric,
we can deconstruct
it
from the radiation.
Eric, can I ask a simple question? A really simple question. What is psi h up there?
It's the Hilbert space of the black hole after this modes have been.
Is it unique, or could it be? Is it some? Do you just put a final state there and calculate a transition amplitude? What? Where is the? People are talking about final state.
You're also asking here.
Either place.
First, if you've settled, there,
I don't
it's the
care.
Same home there.
I don't care. You say they're the same. Is this? Oh God. First question. I don't know what this word virtual means. Virtual to me meant a loop in a Feynman diagram. What are you talking about? What is virtual?
It means that if you look through the evolution process, adding these trivial tensor factors would not. Okay, maybe I should say it this way. Actually, it's related to precisely the point that Ted made in the previous week. If we want to represent the physics locally, we may have to tensor in factors which are local modes, which don't carry any information and are simply entangled. It's precisely what I meant with the entanglement when I put entanglement in a vacuum. How do I measure this entanglement? What I write down here, I write down a network. I mean, can even write down bell pairs, but once bell pairs are given in a unique state, which is this one, and they never get out of it, it may be necessary to describe the local.
We really just don't understand, Eric.
Sorry?
We really don't understand. At least I don't, and I think Don doesn't. I'm not sure who does.
let me make a few comments here.
Okay.
The virtual part of the Hilbert space was also part of Microsoft when he was drawing the sensor network. If you draw a sensor network, one way of thinking about it is that you can see a mirror that you put spins at the sites of your sensor network, and then you project them out. And all those jump up on trains or whatever, you start out with the Hilbert space that's locally defined on your sensor network, which is final state, the one that is actually projected out of the initial bigger Hilbert space. So all these other states in the end are not.
Can I ask
you? Talking about is gauge constraints that are constraining the entanglement between.
So they look like gauge constraints, but I think when you go there locally and you put in an observer, that person can do something with those modes.
Well, that's okay, but are you talking about gauge constraints
between
the
gauge constraints?
The gauge constraints to the extent that those modes are not there. So they project it out of the space, unless someone else goes in there and provides the space.
The point,
I think it would
the
be.
Point, the point is here. I've described the physical Hilbert space here. So anything that I add to the Hilbert space should be gauged. Sorry. Can I? Okay. I think I want to answer the question here, but I mean it was posed to me first. But the maybe I should allow. I mean maybe given the time, I think yeah you can we can make it a switch here. actually, maybe I'll do this. I'll let Herman go along. Yeah, I mean here I've defined the physical Hilbert space. And when I wrote down these equations, I don't think you had any problems because I simply set up the problem like we all do, and I wrote down what is the physical Hilbert space. The only thing that I've done is make use of this observation that the vacuum can also have a representation like this, and I tensored in a factor like that. That's the only thing that I've done. I've done nothing, and I've just composed this map into two things.
So
I think you can go home and even figure out what these two steps are and answer all the questions you're asking me.
I have trouble figuring out the answer myself. I mean, you say it's all in this diagram, but I don't understand the answer to the following two questions, okay? If Alice is falling in and she wants to verify the entanglement of a mode near the horizon with the radiation that was sent off at early times, how does she do it from that diagram, and what is the result she finds? That's question one, and I can either ask the second question or wait till you answer one if you'd like.
So you're imagining that Alice falls in.
Alice falls in.
And she knows about the state, say, of the early radiation. Suppose we would notice.
Alice, that's right.
So this mode is, of course, this mode we know is entangled with the early radiation.
Right. So how does Alice describe that entanglement?
Did she measure that mode?
Yeah. She's going to, we're going to give Alice.
Did she measure that mode?
She has.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry, from here.
It's my question.
Alan, we, knowing the dynamics, have extracted a qubit from your psi r and handed it to Alice. This is the qubit that we think will be using our theory of the universe staying outside that should be entangled with some particular mode that Alice wants to study. Alice is supposed to jump into the black hole.
and compare the qubit we hand her to some particular mode. There are two ways she might do it. I want to know the answer to both questions. One is she does the comparison just outside the horizon before she falls in. The other is she grabs the B mode just outside the horizon, carries it in with her, and does the comparison inside. And I want to know, what does she find in both cases, and how is it explained by that diagram?
Well, I think there are two possibilities, because I think, first of all, she will experience the vacuum, so she has a little bit tough time to get this particle. There's a certain finite chance she gets it.
Yeah.
That finite chance is suppressed by Boltzmann.
So it's a half.
All right. But then...
So she does it on 1,000 modes.
I understand. So you ask me, at the moment when she gets that information, does she... So I think the answer is yes. She will figure out that it's entangled with this one.
Can you explain how that calculation works from your diagram?
I mean, this one was entangled here. So the information that comes out here is the same as the one that's entangled with that one. So the entanglement is in this picture.
But I don't understand. Is she on that line you drew, which is supposed to represent Alice experiencing the vacuum outside the horizon, is she comparing her qubit with which of those intersections of this line with your horizontal line is she using to do the comparison?
Which of these intersections? Oh, this is a quantum mechanical statement that I think we generally have for any particle that propagates outside of its light cone.
So, you're using the two right ones. There's the final state projection that's happening, that inverted part, where the cap there, the triple projection. So, she will find B and BR are entangled for the usual post-selected final state.
I mean, even in the vacuum, there's a finite chance that the particle you measure here actually comes by annihilating this particle with a pre-existing particle, and you measure something outside of the light cone. That has a finite probability. Feynman's propagator is non-zero out of the light cone.
So if she performs that measurement outside the horizon and then falls across, she finds a firewall.
No. Just like if you measure this particle here, this particle has become real. And you know that it has become either from a real particle on the inside, or it simply recombines and does the negative positive. So the point is that if she finds that real particle, it's a real particle for her. And I don't think she's surprised, because she falls into a black hole and she will find out that that information was entangled. I don't think that that's going to be a very dramatic event for her.
Can I understand what you just said? Alice measures by R outside.
Yes.
She measures something
outside.
No? We're good?
Alice measures, can we call it RB?
This is RB. Let's call this RB. Fine.
Yeah, can we call it? Yeah, all right. She measures RB. Maybe she even grabs RB and then goes into the black hole with it. Does she encounter a particle called A that she would not have encountered if she had not measured RB? In effect, does she create a particle behind the horizon by measuring RB?
So RB is the part that's entangled here and shows what it means. Okay, I think in this diagram.
RB is entangled with B.
Can I do the homework? Can I take this as a homework exercise? I mean, Furman, I'll let Furman sort of... Answer the questions. So let's put two objections that were put here this morning next to each other. Okay. Objection one. So can you repeat your question, because I want to give it a good short way of saying it. Let me assume that that's correct way of saying it, that this is post-selection. And what's your objection against post-selection?
Post-selection has the disconcerting part.
Okay, what you will decide. So let me. Can I? This is the objection. So there's a decision that you could make later that could interfere with this. Okay, is that a good way of summarizing your objection? Okay. What? Okay. Now there was another objection that was made this morning, and that's everyone else is saying. Is that when we talk about virtual Hilbert spaces, are we adding something to the theory, or are we subtracting something from the theory? Where is the virtual Hilbert space? Where is it? Okay, let me put that thing here as well. Where is virtual? Okay, so those are the two objections, and now you have to, now at this point you have to decide if you're going to make both of them or one of them. I'm sorry. No.
Can I add one?
No, sorry. Both of them or zero? At least you want to make both, or you want to make one of them at the same at different times. So if you want to make both, because you want to do both. Okay. If you want to do both, I can answer both. If you want to answer one of them, I cannot answer it. If you answer both of them, I can answer them both at the same time. Okay. Because these two same are the same. What you decide to do later is virtual. That if you look up what virtual means, it's the thing that could happen. That's what virtual means. And what you decide to do later is the virtual thing. So if Alice falls in and she decides to do a measure, starts to mess with that thing, and she wants to do something here, she can decide to do that. So she applies some unitary here, she applies some unitary there. It's a virtual process that Alex could decide to do if she falls in. So, okay, well, let her do it. Here's you, Alice, acting on this guy, and there's V, Alice, acting on that guy. Alice has decided that she wanted to do that measurement, and we include that in our Hilbert space, and here's your firewall state. It's part of our Hilbert space. But the firewall was there, and why should we be worried about it? Is Alice surprised that that state is there? No, she's not, because she actually fell in, and she started monkeying with these modes. So I should mention, by the way, that this picture here is the same as what Samir was talking about. Samir was also saying when you fall into the black hole, you bring in extra degrees of freedom. You have the Hilbert space of the object that falls in. And the amount of information that you're adding to the black hole is dependent on the size of the measuring apparatus. And if it's heavy enough, it will add new possibilities to the story. And those new possibilities are these transformations that you can do. And whatever you want to add is things that will act on top of that vacuum. But if you don't fall in, you don't do anything, this thing is just a vacuum. And then this thing reduces to that. So.
Thing about post-selected quantum mechanics is that what you decide to do much later in the future after you've fallen deep into the black hole can influence what you find just when you're at the edge of the black hole. And are you saying that that's not the case in your scenario, or that it's natural property for some reason?
So we would say that if you want to describe what happens from the outside perspective, this is the only picture that you're going to draw. Okay, so this is unitary quantum mechanics. So now we have to decide where to put Alice. Maybe we should talk about where we should put Alice in this picture first. Because let's now take Lenny's question, for example. What happens now if Alice does a measurement on this thing first, and now we get all confused? Actually, we're not getting confused, right? We still quantum mechanics. Let Alice do a measurement here, project it onto some state where there is a particle, RB. She performs that projection.
We know how quantum mechanics works. This is called, maybe call it post-selection. This thing has to contain that particle RB. She's measured it. She projects this thing on the thing that contains that particle. That's how quantum mechanics works. And we told you exactly which operator acts here. So we know exactly which state sits there. What else do you want to know?
When she sees a particle at A.
Okay, let me first do it left, and then I can go to the right. Okay, I do the projection here. Projection onto the mode B. Apply it here. It's a linear map. This is a linear map. I can apply projection onto the mode B here, which is some projection of the fact that we've done this measurement. And now I draw this picture again. And I can do the projection here. This is how quantum mechanics works. If I project this guy here, I should do the projection here. I do the projection there. This is how quantum mechanics works.
Really expected yes or no.
You have a problem with doing projections when you do measurements?
Yes.
You tell me. You're the one that... No, the thing is, okay, so how, first of all, how does Alice know which particle she's going to select here? How does she know the name of this particle? Has she met it before? She knows the initial theory. So she makes use of the initial theory. If you give me a Hamiltonian and you give me an entangled state, I can do all kinds of funny business, because I can probably manipulate. If I give me an entangled electron, entangled with my electron, and I know what the entangled state is, I can project your state onto a down state. Or I can project you on anything. If you give me an entangled state and I know exactly what your Hamiltonian is.
I want to know if by measuring RB, Alice can create a particle in the A mode.
So what you're saying is that, okay, let's imagine that she has measured this here. Because indeed, in the end, in this scenario, we know that this thing is mostly entangled with that. That part we know. So indeed, if you would do a projection here, again, the prescription I'm giving here is correct, right? So if you do the projection here, you project something here, and you project there. In this scenario, in this picture here, the question should really be the following. Is that at the moment where these two things were still before, I should make this picture bigger. So at the moment where these two things were created, since they were created out of the vacuum, this B mode here and the A mode that sits there, up to this point, indeed, it's true that something funny seems to happen, because if I look at it locally, the pair AB doesn't contain any information. This is in a uniquely entangled pair. And it actually also, this is an important point that should be emphasized, is that particular pair doesn't contain, at this point, any information about this initial state. The information about the initial state is here, is carried by these things and not by this line here. But of course, at the moment that we've actually gone through this transition, then this thing does contain phase information about the initial state by means of the coefficient that sits here, because this thing here depended on the initial state, and this thing carries out information from the initial state. So there's indeed a funny transition that happens between here and there. And the transition is the transition between a virtual pair and a real pair. And
A question?
Yes.
So I'm just trying to understand your diagram. And my question is whether this is describing the kind of model that Steve Giddings has explored about a non-local transfer of information between initially creating a vacuum pair, and then slightly later there's some new physics which transfers, both deletes the ingoing Hawking quantum and changes the outgoing quantum in order to make things unitary.
Right. So the crux of the question, indeed, that we're grappling with is that, on the one hand, there's the quantum information theoretic story, and there's the maybe even the ADS-CFT story, where if we don't worry too much about locality and effective field theory, then we have no problem whatsoever to writing down a unitary evolution where there is some kind of non-local process, we think it's non-local, that emits some particles from a black hole. It's the CFT, it's the interaction Hamiltonian of the CFT that's doing this thing. It's some kind of complicated thing. The mystery then becomes that once this thing comes out, then we can ask, okay, well, what does it take for this particle to come out? And we go back to Hawking, and then Hawking actually had this beautiful semi-classical calculation that was also predicting that these particles were coming out. So then the question becomes, where is local effective field theory in this story? So it's the transition between sort of a story where locality is not obvious, which is what ADS-CFT is, and a story where we want to maintain the locality. Now, there is indeed, that's really where the crux of the question is. But I want to emphasize, again, that that question has sort of two parts, because there's this line here where if you ask questions about the outgoing state, and you ask, well, which mode was entangled with this mode, then that's at least locally here a very difficult question to ask. And one of the reasons for why it's a difficult question to ask is because it involves the backward calculating backwards in time, right? That's what we talked about. If you compute this thing backwards in time and you want to know what's entangled with, difficult calculation. But if you ask in the final state what is entangled with, yes, we all agree it's entangled with that.
So then is it correct that the answer to Don's question was, if Alice went in and tried to measure this B as it had just been created before from the vacuum but before this transfer of entanglement, that B is not entangled with RB, and just after the transfer of entanglement...
At this point, it was part of what we call the virtual Hilbert space, right. And indeed, the question you could ask, what is the non-local physics that takes place here? But that non-locality, the notion of locality, is only something that you can actually answer once you have actually a dictionary where you can extract local physics from the quantum mechanics.
So when this prediction
So the question
takes,
is, how does local effective field theory come out of that picture? And then you can say, well, how does local effective field theory explain this? And then I agree with you that stories, that the scenarios that the non-local effects that maybe in the Philpott or that Steve has been talking about could be part of that particular story, but that goes into the translation between the quantum mechanics and the effective field.
So before the projection B is entangled with A and after the projection B is entangled with RB.
But from the outside, there's no projection.
There's never a projection from the outside, that's correct. From the inside, actually, again, this is part of the point, is that the projection here is always compatible with the fact that at this point you expanded the Hilbert space.
So I'm confused, because last week we had this nice lecture by John Preskill about post-selection scenarios, which, as far as I understand, is very much like what you're talking about here. And he concluded that they were only consistent if there was what he called an extreme fine-tuning of the dynamics. So I want to understand, are you agreeing with him that your scenario is of this kind, and it requires what a priori seems like an extreme fine-tuning of the dynamics to predict prevent contradictions, or
Let me talk a little bit about
resolve that issue.
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about dynamics here.
Hermit, it's cookie time. How are you doing in terms of your overall plan?
I'll answer this question, and then we can go to cookies, and then.
Oh, there's no cookies. Okay.
Okay. Never mind.
Carry on. Eric wants to say something. Or not? So at least
So we never fully discussed Subra. Did I ask at one point whether you and Subra would take all the same creations?
First answer this question, and then maybe Subrat would have a chance to either start now or immediately after a short break. Or what's the idea?
We don't need a break, right?
Okay, good. If we're all.
Yeah.
Right. We could have people come. We can have Subrat come up and.
Yeah. Sum up. We break right. Briefly and then. Okay. And, we can even call all three of you up here.
Yeah, let me then very briefly answer this question. So at the end, one of the very interesting things about John's talk was that at the end he had sort of this more randomized, sort of this highly entangled final state prescription where the level of tuning, or at least, yeah. So he had a formula where basically he got rid of a lot of the objections with respect to tuning. By having this entangled state at the end of the final state, and then
certain objections.
Yeah, there were objections, but basically because he's explaining his story as a final state projection. But if one would have realized from the beginning that at this point one is actually extending something, so you had an objection against doing this step, and you have an objection to doing this step. So the two objections. And what I'm saying is that the two objections have everything to do with each other. At the moment that you're adding the Hilbert space, you're adding the possibilities at this point of doing these particular measurements. But the state that you're adding here, and let me mention this then, the state, so there's a funny thing in the final state projection that's going to happen, is that if you're going to do a measurement here, and you decide to do a measurement there, then this state already knows about it. Because at that point, you actually are going to do this unitary on one lag, you're going to do this thing on the other lag, and according to this prescription, the state that you're going to put here is going to be the firewall state. It's going to be the corresponding firewall state. So that's our prescription. Is that,
but that some of the complications moment, arise if you try to
oh,
mix
sorry,
them.
Maybe not this one. This one here will be, sorry, am I saying this right? Sorry, at this point. Created the firewall state.
Some of the issues involve sort of mixing the legs. Like if you fell in, captured a B photon, and just dragged it with you into the black hole so it never went out, then it looks like you're making this little dip, something which doesn't act as a unitary transformation.
Yeah. So let me just state the way we think about it. And then it needs a homework exercise to answer all those questions that you're asking.
Your homework or more?
Your homework. We've done your homework for the last year and a half, almost.
You should finish.
So let this be the moment where you guys are starting to do our homework. So, So the scenario that we're proposing is that, indeed, if you accept this point of view, that one can tensor in a local vacuum, because essentially it's the picture, as I was mentioning, is that if you, for example, with ADS-CFT or in other ways of representing a patch of space-time, you want to have certain conditions that tell you that neighboring space-time points are related. And those things are done with conditions. And since in the ADS-CFT way of thinking about it, every possible state can be written down without any prescribed relations, we've kind of lost this ability of writing down anything that has locally entangled.
So what we do is we say, well, we're going to introduce what we call then a placeholder, where someone who's going to do local experiments can act on a part of the Hilbert space that we're just censoring in. It's a vacuum state. So at that point, we're making maybe an extension, but it's, we will justify that extension by saying this Hilbert space is the one that the observer, say the form factors of someone who is outside of the CFT and wants to interact with the CFT, the Hilbert space of the form factors that interact with the CFT will be acting on this thing. And then all your puzzles that you can ask about all the experiments that Alice can do have to be put in this particular context in such a way that indeed in the end you can take this picture where Alice is doing all kinds of things and you can put it in this form. You should be able to always go from here to there. And if you can do that, this is maybe what you would want to call the complementarity map. This is, yeah, let's write it down, complementarity, is that whatever Alice can do here has to be consistently projected onto this picture. So that's our proposal.
Sorry, can I ask my question now, which I think is relevant to these questions about post-selection? Because I'm confused by what is the difference between what people are calling post-selection and what seems to be your point, which is to just consider the naturally formed states of the system. You might describe it in terms of these NAs and NBs, almost all of which states of that Fock space never form, whatever you say.
At least you will never be able to change these Ns without doing something active.
Right, so what's the difference between what people are calling post-selection, which is not quantum mechanics, and just describing all of the naturally formed states of the system, period, without adding anything more?
The three-point vertex.
Roll what, okay. Well, are they? I mean, that's my question.
We're not changing quantum mechanics. Again, this thing is... No, the thing is... Right, something is happening here. Eric had the equation here, at least I erased it, where he took the state where I had the extra piece and then he projected down. So he had an intermediate, basically there's an intermediate step between going here, there's an intermediate step to this emission process that's been added. That's correct. So if you keep all the branches, so our prescription is unitary by definition, because that's the requirement, that the picture, once you go to here, should be unitary. And therefore, unitarity is always a postulate of our description. So we're not projecting anything out of the description here. So we're not post-selecting. We're representing it as a scenario where there seems to be a post-selection step.
Right. In that representation, there's post-selection.
In that representation, there's post-selection.
So there is, in that diagram, there is non-unitarity between the slice that sort of describes the smooth horizon and the final state.
Right, but it doesn't mean that the quantum mechanics is non-unitary.
From the external perspective, I understand.
Which, of course, is also what Kwan and Gary were saying. No, but I had very little criticism, actually, of what Kwan and Gary were saying, except for the moment that they were putting in the state where they just sort of added a sentence saying, well, we're adding this thing to the Hilbert space as a way of being able to represent what happens to an observer. They should have said, well, we're taking a sidestep here, but we'll correct for it later. But I think at that point, this was just assumed that this was a reasonable thing to do, because of the whole debate about anyone who previously was arguing that information was lost and didn't have any problem with tensoring in this thing here, which actually was the reason for why information was lost, because everyone was tensoring in this thing all the time.
This is how
information gets lost. You keep tensoring that in.
Are you tensoring now, in many
and now
states?
If you do it once, so it's these two problems cancel out.
So are you tensoring in many states or one state? I mean, that's what's confusing me.
It depends on how many modes you want to include here. If you do only the modes of quantum field theory that are locally accessible within a certain amount of time, you can do it once, but then you have to do it many times over. if you do throughout the whole evolution of the black hole, time evolution, since the black hole lives for a very long time and there are very many local quantum field theory states associated with it. If you want to do it at once, you can do it at once, but then you're kind of idealizing the situation. Maybe I want to give the floor to someone who...
Really, break and we'll give you a phone.